Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a China conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. China, as in the second most populated country in the world after India with 1.4 billion people. In this episode, we dive deeper into the connection between China and fentanyl. ProPublica's recent publication quoted that fentanyl has killed over 450,000 Americans over the past decade, more than U.S. deaths in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan combined. The numbers are outrageous, and many consider this an attack on America. We experience an equivalent of two 9/11 deaths every month, every year from fentanyl. And fentanyl is the number one cause of death for Americans age 18 to 45. We talk about solutions such as naloxone, addiction treatment, primary prevention, education measures. That's all very important. However, we must go upstream to the source and origin of the supply chain. We have known for some time that China is a supplier of fentanyl, but a recent expose published in ProPublica infers that the Chinese government is behind fentanyl production and even produced through their prison system. Is this a deliberate weaponization on America? All about profit or just rogue mafia and criminals? To learn more about China, I reach out to Sebastian Rotella. Sebastian Rotella is an award-winning foreign correspondent, investigative reporter, and novelist. His reporting has taken him across the world to more than 30 countries. Since 2010, he's been a senior reporter at ProPublica, covering international security issues such as organized crime and intelligence. He is a two-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's been an invited speaker at the FBI and other government agencies, at foreign embassies, think tanks, and universities. His coverage of the U.S.-Mexican border inspired two songs by Bruce Springsteen. To learn more about Sebastian Rotella, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Sebastian on May 2nd, 2025. Sebastian Rotella, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
I am very excited for this to meet you and to learn more from you. And we have to start with a shout out for Jim Rao from Families Against Fentanyl, who made this connection. So shout out to him. I know you interviewed
Absolutely.
Him. Yeah. Okay. And this came about by reading your article in ProPublica about Chinese prisons making fentanyl. And we're going to get to that because that, you know, that was the focus. But I realized that there's so much more in your experience. So let's start with your background. Your career, I think you said, started as a foreign correspondent. And tell us what that means and where that took you.
I was with the LA Times, the Los Angeles Times, for 23 years. And I was based, my first big job there was based at the Mexican border in San Diego, Tijuana, covering the border and Mexico during a very intense period of drug wars and immigration and corruption in Mexico. And so I really learned a lot about, you know, that world of law enforcement and drug trafficking and migration and just working in a foreign country. And after that, I was with the LA Times as a foreign correspondent based in Buenos Aires and Rio de Janeiro, covering all of South America, which was also extremely exciting and challenging. And then as the Paris bureau chief, and I was also based in Madrid. So I had a career sort of covering all around the world, and usually issues related to law enforcement, organized crime, drug trafficking, migration, terrorism. And after 9/11, I spent a lot of time on terrorism. But that's always, my focus has always been on crime, justice, international issues, And I've had the good fortune of, you know, working around the world, you know, many regions, the Middle East, India, but Latin America and Europe in particular.
Wow. And what made you want to be a reporter? Is that something that you wanted to do at a young age?
I was always interested in writing, and I spoke languages because I'm the son of immigrants from Spain and Italy. So I did a lot of traveling as a kid and just had a lot of interest in foreign culture. So the idea of writing, of working overseas, writing fiction also, which is something I've done, and I published 3 novels, but all those things kind of came together. But what really appealed to me about journalism, I think, was the mix of sort of the world of ideas and the world of the street, you know, and kind of being able to, you know, at the one, you know, moving at sort of an intellectual level, but also being out on the street and the adrenaline and challenge of that. So that's kind of what I think propelled me into journalism.
Yeah. And then you became from a correspondent to an investigative reporter, right? So that made you even more of a detective.
I think so, because as a correspondent, I was drawn to these issues that really require investigative work, you know, and especially in a foreign culture and a foreign language and places that are full of corruption and treachery and intrigue where the truth is elusive, you know, working in a place like Latin America, for example. So even when I wasn't formally an investigative reporter, that was a lot of what I was doing. And I had the great fortune in 2010 to be hired. I moved to ProPublica, where I work now, which does only in-depth investigative journalism, and where they really allowed me to continue my focus on international issues, but with, you know, this real investigative approach, which has allowed me to do, you know, in-depth stories around the world, to do pieces partnering with Frontline, like PBS, doing documentaries with the New York Times, with the Washington Post. But increasingly, ProPublica has become, we have so many readers now, millions of readers on our own platform, that are really, you know, doing the work with them, has allowed me to combine the international interest with the investigative interest and write pieces that are in depth and written hopefully in a intense and evocative way to get into some of these very difficult issues of the international underworlds that interest me.
Yeah. Actually, I just love reading your articles. They're very different than other people because they read like a novel. There's always a character. In reading, you know, your investigative serious journalism, they still read like a novel. There's always the character and drama, and, you know, I feel like it's a scene out of the Chinese Godfather, you know.
Well, thank you. But that's nice of you to say, but you're right. And I think what it is, you know, though I think I do strive for that in the writing, but that requires even more rigorous reporting, you know, because it's all very based on fact. But when I tried to do reporting that is not only focused on the big picture issues, but also the small details of how people talk and dress and move and you know, that bring alive the scene. And I find that if you propose to someone, look, I'm going to do a story about Chinese organized crime involved in the laundering of drug money, that could be very dry mm-hmm. or not. If you can find, as you say, a good character, a good case that sums it up and really bring about the personalities and the humanity and the drama of it, I think it makes it much easier for people to connect to an issue that otherwise might not sound like something they want to wade through. So I do try to write them in as sort of an evocative, exciting, a literary way as possible, but without ever sacrificing the facts and the rigor, right? So that's sort of the double challenge.
Yeah, but you do it. And also I would add, you have graphics. There are pictures.
Right, so that helps.
That adds.
Sometimes you need either photos or graphics that explain, or we have very good folks at ProPublica sometimes where it's about a secret world where they do they do illustrations, you know, where we don't, you know, sometimes we don't have photos. And I find that also in my fiction, I'm still, though it's there are stories that are quote unquote made up, I very much, you know, my journalism has helped me in that I try and make things as realistic and authentic as possible based on my experience.
Yep. And as I mentioned, I'm in the middle of reading the Triple Crossing, and it feels like a combination of your regular reporting, but in a novel form. So you actually, and that's all fun. I was saying how entertaining it is to read real stories from you and the fiction one. But it's really serious. I mean, you mentioned that you, the FBI, U.S. intelligence agencies, you brief them on your reports. Isn't that strange? Isn't that their job?
Well, I think, you know, I've had the good fortune, as you said, to have been invited to speak at the FBI, at the NYPD Intelligence Division, at other places. Recently at U.S. Southern Command, I was at a conference talking about these Chinese issues. I think it's not that I'm a huge expert, but, you know, we journalists sometimes, especially if we do things overseas, we can move around in a way and talk to a lot of different police forces and agencies. And sometimes people in law enforcement have some limits to that, right? Or they're so focused on cases and getting people convicted and protecting us, right, that they don't always have time to delve into some of the issues that are of interest, but are kind of secondary to making the case, so to speak. So I think people in the world of journalism and the world of human rights and other areas, sometimes we have some knowledge that maybe can be helpful to folks in that arena. And so, yeah, it's an honor. You know, I'm honored when I'm invited to do things like that. And I feel it's part of my duty as a journalist to do it. And it's often a great exchange, because after all, throughout my career, who I've learned from are people in law enforcement, people in intelligence, people on the front lines. And so that's a great dialogue to have. And it's always an honor when I'm invited to do things like that.
Yeah. And back to your novels, you also had a journalist as a key figure in your book as well. So that was kind of cool.
That's true. In two of the three novels, it alternates between two protagonists. One is an American in the first novel, he's a Border Patrol agent. In the second one, he's a former Border Patrol agent. But the other character is very much inspired by Mexican and Latin American journalists I've known. You know, and in those countries, journalists often end up doing the work that police and prosecutors should be doing, but, you know, sometimes they're either corrupt or, you know, intimidated. So I've met a lot of journalists, including ones who were killed, you know, who do remarkably brave and frontline work in those countries. And that character is to some extent inspired by and a tribute to them.
And then it doesn't stop there as far as, you know, inspiring things in novels, but also music. Bruce Springsteen wrote some songs based on your work. How did that happen?
Yes, that was, you know, and I was a relatively young journalist, and, you know, some of my colleagues, you know, how journalists are, they could be kind of sarcastic. They were like, well, you're done, because nothing better is ever going to happen to you. But as a young journalist covering actually the border in San Diego, Tijuana, I wrote, I was covering the border day in, day out, and writing about a lot of dramatic things. And it turned out that Bruce Springsteen at the time was living in Los Angeles and reading the Los Angeles Times. And he did this album called The Ghost of Tom Joad, which was about immigrants and drifters and you know, folks sort of in the shadows. And two of the songs were inspired by stories I wrote. One was about street kids in Balboa Park in San Diego, where we were actually cross-border street kids, Mexican and other immigrants, who were in a very grim situation, living as homeless in the park, involved in prostitution and drug trafficking. And I did an in-depth piece where I spent time with them and people who were trying to help them on both sides of the border. And that struck Bruce Springsteen. And he wrote a song about that called Balboa Park. And he wrote another one inspired on some of my writing about Border Patrol agents and crossers. And so he ended up, you know, inviting me to the concert and where he premiered it in Los Angeles. I ended up meeting him and over the years having some, you know, conversations with him, seeing him at concerts and whatnot. But it was a remarkable thing. It's a beautiful song, Balboa Park in particular, where you can see that he took this story, you know, changed some of the names and whatnot, but really used the images and emotions of it and about this beautiful and haunting song about these sort of endangered and doomed kids. And it was really one of the highlights of my career.
Yeah, that is pretty, you know, a rock star.
That's right. That's right. And a very thoughtful, informed one, you know what I mean, who really took time. Occasionally then he would read stories I was writing, say, when I was in Latin America covering something, he'd call me and, you know, and say, oh, I read this, and, you know, and be curious to learn more. And my first book, which was a nonfiction book about the border called Twilight on the Line, he read and you know, he gave a blurb for it, but he actually sat there and read it, you know what I mean, and thought about it. So I was very impressed by it.
That is impressive. So the reason I reached out was the first article I read or knew that attributed to you was The Fentanyl Pipeline, How a Chinese Prison Helped Fuel a Deadly Drug Crisis in the United States. And I think that's your most recent story. But having read several of your stories and mentioning each of these is, you know, is fact and your is reporting, but also tells a story. So can you, with that theme, tell us a story of this Chinese prison?
To put it in context, I've been doing this work for the past several years about Chinese organized crime and the Chinese state and how the two connect and the ways in which that affects us right here in the United States and affects people in Latin America and other things, particularly in the world of drug trafficking. I did a story a couple of years ago about how Chinese organized crime has really become the dominant player in laundering money for the Mexican cartels that bring fentanyl and other drugs into the country, and how the Chinese state, you know, there's a lot of evidence that it plays a role in that, whether actively or passively, whether through laundering in which the Chinese elite is involved or connections back to the state through diaspora association. There's a lot of different ways in which the Chinese state appears to be involved in this activity because it enriches China and it also extends China's power around the world. And one of the central issues, obviously, was with the rise of fentanyl. And I've been covering drug trafficking for, you know, many years, but there's nothing that compares to the past 10 years to the deadliness and the overwhelming impact of fentanyl in this country. As you know, the fentanyl and fentanyl precursors and fentanyl analogs come in large part are manufactured in the Chinese pharmaceutical and chemical industry. And I looked in depth at with the work the U.S. government has been doing to understand that and to try and stop it and the difficulties it has had, despite, you know, great expenditure, diplomatic contact, all that. And, you know, looked at this case that more and more U.S. officials are making, which is that which is showing that there are connections between the Chinese government, the Chinese Communist Party, and different activities related to fentanyl traffic. One of the main sort of, as you say, to tell the story, you look for a specific case. And there was a case that was revealed by a congressional investigation last year, which we dug into further, which was there are a number of Chinese state-owned companies that are very involved in fentanyl trafficking. And one of them we discovered was this prison, right? It's a prison in the province of Hebei. And public records show and investigations show that it owns a network of very typical fentanyl trafficking companies or companies involved in the trafficking of fentanyl precursors and analogs, and has and did so for at least 8 years. And the company was called Yafeng. It was the hub of a network of companies, and it was very typical in this underworld. As you know, what is striking about what's going on in China is, though, China has very strict laws against trafficking within China and blocks the internet, so people in China cannot buy these kind of products. Yet, the government allows these companies, including this company that was owned by this prison, to openly broadcast and advertise on the internet in English that they're selling these products that are illegal, often in both countries, right? And so we discovered that this company and show how this these companies owned by the prison were actively trafficking to the United States and doing things like on the English language websites, basically promoting drugs that were illegal and describing, as many of these companies do, despite the power of the Chinese police state to monitor its internet. They say in English, we will smuggle this past U.S. Customs. We guarantee smuggling. We will hide the drugs in bags to make it look like food product. There was another company similar to this one that would even show with photos, here's the product, the illegal product we're going to send to you. We're going to disguise it as nuts or dog food or motor oil. So it's remarkably brazen, again, in a society where the government and the authorities and the police state has enormous power. And of course, what is striking about this example is you're talking about a prison, which is actually part of the law enforcement apparatus, yet it is involved in this criminal activity, sending these fentanyl precursors and analogs directly to the United States and to Mexico, where, you know, the precursors are used to produce fentanyl and then smuggle it in.
So I'm imagining prisoners in uniforms mixing chemicals or working in a lab. Is that how? When you're saying
that, we don't, that part, obviously, all of this is very difficult to investigate. So we have bits and pieces. We don't know if the company was actually using inmates to produce in the prison. We think it's more likely there are other examples of other companies in the pharmaceutical and medical business. Because remember, one thing that is clear is that prisons throughout China use extensively inmate labor, and many prisons own companies or work partner with companies, right? Because it's a great economic benefit to use inmate labor, slave labor for free, right? Yeah. So the suspicion is that the inmates are involved in some aspect, but probably something more like packaging in the later stages. That at least is what we have seen in other cases that are comparable. But one of the mysteries that has not yet been revealed, and obviously the Chinese government in a general way denies involvement and in a specific way has not even engaged us on this issue. But one of the mysteries is what role exactly is the prison running this, owning this company, and what activity is happening on the prison premises? What is it happening as an investment in outside factories? What exactly is the role, for example, as you say, the inmates? But the suspicion is that there's some use of inmate labor. And the obvious question it raises is, if a prison is owning companies that are involved in this activity, is it possible that it's just one prison? Right? Is this like the only prison in China, or is this going on elsewhere? Right?
Yeah.
And the congressional report and our reporting and DEA cases show a number of companies that have different connections to the Chinese state, whether they're state owned or whether they have Communist Party members on their boards that are involved in this activity as well.
And so the prison is owned by the Chinese government, correct?
The prison is a big high-security prison run by the provincial government of the province of Hebei. So, yes, it is a state institution. Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, that's pretty direct. That's the state of China sending fentanyl over.
I mean, that's why we chose it as the opening example in the story, which looks at other examples, but it is one of the more dramatic ones. We also know, we talked to 36 officials, U.S. and other officials at a number of law enforcement intelligence agencies that looked in lots and lots of cases and whatnot and government studies. We know that it's quite frequent for the Chinese security forces and the Chinese military to run side hustles, sometimes just normal legitimate companies and sometimes criminal enterprises, and combine, for example, espionage type activities and making money on the side. You know what I mean? Whether like hacking, right, for example, and so keep the profits. Or we know that in there was one former FBI chief told me about a province in China where the Ministry of Public Security ran a number of karaoke bars, which actually made money, but then also were great for gathering intelligence on people, because you have karaoke bars, and with prostitution and things like that, there was a way of gathering information. So the idea that the state is involved in activity that is criminal, there's both a corruption aspect, but then there's the question of what is the motivation, if the Chinese state is involved, for continuing to bombard the United States with fentanyl. And that's another sort of one of the classic questions at the heart of this issue.
Right. So let's get to that. So what are the incentives? Is this, payback from the opioid wars? Is this money, or is it deliberately weakening America, which it is?
And it's a very difficult question, and one that the U.S. national security community, as far as I can tell from having talked to people at every conceivable agency, current and former, high level and front line, that people have wrestled with. I'd say most of the folks I talked to in law enforcement and intelligence felt that there was some intentionality here. In other words, that it's impossible that the Chinese state cannot prevent this, right? And that there's at least a passive sort of involvement, right, of letting it happen. And that obviously this benefits, because the Chinese chemical and pharmaceutical industry is very prosperous, and so that this benefits the country and it benefits politicians in specific provinces, because the way it works in the Chinese state is if your province has a good GDP, for example, you rise in the Communist Party hierarchy. So there's an economic, financial, political benefit to state officials. But there is this feeling among many U.S. officials that there's also an attempt to weaken the United States. After all, this is causing great strife. It's causing overdoses. It's causing death, causes division. And there is that thinking. Now, we in the story try to be very careful. There are a number of very high ranking, prominent folks, including the former Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, including Ray Donovan, a former chief of the DEA, who feel that this is an intentional, and say it publicly, that this is an intentional plan to weaken the U.S. by the Chinese government.
And it's effective.
And if it's true, it's effective. There are others who, and one of the things, the points we did make in the story is that most of the people we talked to feel that though they have looked, and the U.S. intelligence community has looked, they haven't found the kind of smoking gun evidence you would need to make that conclusion. Say, we have, say, wiretaps of Chinese generals discussing this plan. You know what I'm saying? That is missing. So we have to be careful and say, a lot of people think this is what is going on. They haven't found the proof. But then there's two other issues, which is the general difficulty of gathering intelligence on China, which is one of the hardest targets for U.S. intelligence. It's just very difficult. There's a language problem. They're the very secretive apparatus that is very impervious to intelligence gathering. And the fentanyl issue in particular, for many years, and this is a concern that people at the DEA, the FBI, the HSI, CIA will tell you about, is that it was treated as a law enforcement challenge and not a national security challenge. So, you know, it was more like, we're looking at this question of, this is criminal activity, but these are legitimate companies. And then it sort of bumps up again the Chinese state. Oh, that's a counterintelligence issue. And law enforcement doesn't really look at that. On the other side, the U.S. intelligence agencies are looking more at what the Chinese state does, but not really at criminal activity. So, oh, that's not really our specialty either. So it kind of fell between the cracks until the past couple of years, where, as you know, having been involved in it, that this became such a important and urgent and dire political issue that there's been more of an attempt to try and understand it. But I think most experts will tell you that this has been a struggle because it goes to kind of the nature of the Chinese state, right? There are people who know China well, who feel, well, you know, there isn't as much control as you think. They'll tell you that the Chinese government is more sort of anarchic and corrupt and has less control than you think. And they feel that it's more a passive acceptance that this is going on and it's difficult to control. But most people feel and suspect that there is some intentionality, that this has been going on long enough and the U.S. has sort of reached out and urged and requested China to do something, that there just hasn't been the kind of response. The other thing we look at in the story is the lack of cooperation that has gone on for the past 10 years of the fentanyl crisis, the repeated lack of Chinese action to shut down these companies, and the lack of when the DEA has tried to share information on targets, the Chinese government either failing to act, and one thing we've heard over and over, even warning the targets. The DEA and HSI agents will tell you, we reached out about a specific company. They asked us for more information, and then we could tell through our sources and our monitoring that the companies and the suspects changed names, changed emails, changed phone numbers, that there was clearly a reaction that we learned that they had been warned. So the other problem here is, why is the Chinese government for so many years just really failed to cooperate, right? I mean, we quoted someone from the Biden administration saying basically we couldn't get them on the phone for several years to talk about this, right? There was zero cooperation. There's been some improvement in the past year, but most people will tell you it has to be much more profound and structural and aggressive to make a difference.
Right. And they say, of course, we don't have a fentanyl problem. America has a fentanyl problem because your citizens have a cultural problem and they like fentanyl.
And that's right. The response, the Chinese government, the one argument they make that I think is the strongest one is they say in 2019, they did schedule fentanyl and some of its analogs, and that reduced, it didn't end, but it reduced the direct flow of fentanyl to the U.S. As you know, before then, you know, and we wrote about it in the story, you know, teenagers could go online and get sent these deadly drugs in the mail. And that's why the death toll in the U.S. skyrockets. So the Chinese government does take that step, but what happens? It accentuates a shift that was already going on, where the precursors are being sent from the same Chinese companies that were sending the fentanyl to the U.S. to Mexico, and the Mexican cartels become kind of weaponized and expand their production, and the smuggling and the death toll just continue to rise because there's kind of like this, you know, this shift of precursors coming into Mexico, and that has also been something that we have, you know, worked very hard to try and get the Chinese government to cooperate on. And again, it's not helping. So has not really been a sense that there has been dramatic, important action by the Chinese government to cooperate, to help on this. Obviously, this is with the new administration, this has been a very high priority. The tariffs that have been imposed early in the administration were specifically focused on this. So we will see if this tougher approach maybe makes some difference.
Yeah. You know, what made it interesting is in the prison connection is I've had Ben Westhoff, who wrote the Fentanyl Inc., and he went to China and he saw some of these labs. And he explained that the labs, like during the day, are making legit medications, right? And then at night, you know, then they have their fentanyl production. So it's like you were mentioning, a side gig. But with a prison, I can't imagine that it, you know, that's, you know, you're doing something correct in the day and then something else at night. And it's all from the same company, which is, you said, directly from the Chinese government.
I mean, and Ben Westhoff, you know, hats off to him, because he's done some of the most important groundbreaking work. And I think a lot of the people who've looked at this issue have followed his intrepid reporting. You know, he shows these connections where you have state companies involved in this, right? Both specific companies, but then general incentive. One of the things that I believe he wrote about, and certainly this congressional report and other sources revealed in the past year, is that at the central government level, there are tax incentives to these companies to produce and export drugs that are illegal in China. So as the head investigator of the Congressional Commission said, you could theoretically get the death penalty for selling these drugs at home, but if you sell them to Americans and Mexicans, that's fine, right? And there's billions of dollars that the Chinese government ends up spending through these tax rebates, right, to these companies that foment this activity. So that is very concerning and very damning, right? And so that is one thing that when you look at it as a big picture question, it's very concerning. Also, because one of the arguments, and as you said, it's a very odd and wild west type of industry where people are making different products, some of them totally innocuous and some of them totally dangerous at the same time, the same company. But one of the things that the Chinese government and others have argued is, well, the industry is not very well regulated. It's very hard to figure out who's doing what and who's selling it to enforce it. But in order to get these tax rebates, these companies have to specify the products they're making, how much they're making. They have to leave a paper trail, right, to get the money. So yeah, that undercuts, that refutes this argument that, well, we just can't possibly figure out who's doing it, right? Mm-hmm. There's a certain amount of, you know, hubris here. I talked to a high-ranking U.S. official who had negotiations with the Chinese government, and he was talking to them about the fact that you could, you know, that their internet is so controlled that if someone gets on the internet and starts saying, you know, I miss, or I'm thinking today about the Tiananmen Square massacre and, you know, and what a horrible day it was, you know, the oppression of that era, the government go out, find them and put them in jail, right? So he said, you know, sarcastically, he said to his Chinese interlocutors, it's unfortunate that you don't have control over your internet, or you could do something about it. Obviously, they do have control over their internet, yet, you know, all these companies are out there with these ads, you know, in English mainly, you know, openly and brazenly engaged in this activity. So
yeah,
this has been the challenge.
I think others agree that it feels like an attack, especially if we think about, you know, if COVID came from China, fentanyl came from China at the same time, and it's really brilliant strategy because it effectively really harmed America and continues to do that. I think that's why I'd like to hear your opinion of it. Fentanyl being weaponized against us, and fentanyl should be declared a weapon of mass destruction.
That's certainly the weapon of mass destruction is something that Jim Rao in particular, who lost his son to fentanyl, has talked about. I think, look, we tried to be very careful presenting the evidence where it appears to point, presenting the other points of view, saying that there isn't yet this smoking gun intelligence that you would want in order to make the definitive charge. But it certainly seems hard to imagine that this could go on so long without at least tacit approval or involvement. And let's say this, if in fact the smaller number of people who feel that this isn't intentional are right, and this is more that the Chinese government doesn't have the control it needs to have and it's just very corrupt, that is also that's also extremely concerning, right? If this isn't intentional, if this is just that they can't control it and want to, then what does that say about one of the most powerful countries, you know, economically and politically and police states in the world? So it's a profound problem. It goes to the heart of this, you know, regime that has enormous power, not only over its territory and over his diaspora. And that's another thing that's important to remember. The other big piece of evidence on this, as I think we've showed and others have showed, is the money laundering. You know, organized crime and drug trafficking, you know, they make money. And one of the things they do is they launder money. There is no question that Chinese organized crime has taken over money laundering in the Americas for the Mexican cartels, strengthening both Chinese organized crime and the cartels, and greatly fomenting and expanding fentanyl trafficking, right? And we've shown that there's all kinds of different connections between that laundering and the Chinese state, partly because the Chinese elite uses money laundering to get its money out of China, to get its fortunes out of China. We've shown how Chinese organized crime figures in Mexico and the United States realized in the past 10 years that they could sell the profits, the dollars that the Mexican cartels were making on the streets of the United States to Chinese elites who were willing to lose money to get their money out. So they became central to the enterprise. And you see all this money and all these investigations moving back into China and through Chinese banks and companies. So again, that's another sort of, if you're making a case like a prosecutor is like, how is that possible? That is so fundamental to fentanyl trafficking, the money laundering. And it's going on brazenly, you know, every day. And I think there's even stronger evidence of all kinds of connections to Chinese companies, to the Chinese government, to Chinese organized crime in different places, having connections to the Chinese state, because Chinese organized crime tends to sort of work, because it has great control over the diaspora, it tends to work with the Chinese state in places like the United States and Europe and Latin America. And so that's another aspect of this, is the money laundering as a pillar on which this fentanyl trafficking is based.
Yeah, and you did a great story on that, including graphics showing how the money is laundered. In your article, I think it was how a Chinese-American gangster transformed money. Can you tell us the story of, and I'm going to botch his name, but Zizhi Li?
Zizhi Li.
Zizhi Li. Okay, tell us about his story.
So he's a fascinating character, and it's interesting because As we were talking about, I covered the Mexican border years ago and you know, keep up on the drug trafficking underworld. And I know exactly the area he's from, sort of both geographically and sociologically, but was struck to discover that this quiet takeover had happened of money laundering. So just to take you to Zizhi Li. Zizhi Li grows up in southern China. His family migrates to Mexico when he's a child. He grows up in Mexicali, you know, which is a long time, I mean, going back a century, center of a Chinese immigrant community on the border of California, where there's a lot of, you know, hardworking and legitimate immigrants, but there's always been an underworld involved in smuggling. And he grows up in that underworld, connected to a Chinese triad called the 14K, which is a very powerful international Chinese mafia. As a young man, his family then moves to Southern California. So he's really Chinese, Mexican, American. He has the three languages, the three cultures. And from a young age, he's involved in the smuggling of drugs and immigrants, mainly Chinese ones. And he's connected both to the Chinese organized crime, but also to the Mexican cartels. And he speaks Spanish. At some point, he marries a woman who's connected to the Mexican cartels. So he's grows up in an environment that combines the three cultures and these organized crime groups. And in the late sort of 2000, early 2010s, he realizes, he's one of the pioneers in Chinese organized crime because he understands the trafficking underworld, right, at the border and in Mexico and the United States. He realizes that the money to be made is not as there's a lot of money to be made in drugs, but the area to be get involved in that he moves into is the laundering of money. And so how does that work? Until then, money laundering for the cartels. The cartels wanted to get the dollars. They're making all these dollars, millions of dollars in cash on the streets of the United States. They needed to get it back to Mexico and turn it into pesos, right? That was a difficult process. When I was covering the border long ago, they were actually moving it back in cars and trucks, physically moving the cash back to Mexico in houses that were filled with cash. That was a difficult process. The money was exposed to getting ripped off, to getting busted, to, you know, damage. They started using then other methods, using banks, using Colombian launderers through something called the black market peso exchange. But what characterized all these methods were that they were expensive. They would pay as much as 18% on the dollar. And they were laborious. It could take, you know, weeks and even months to get the money laundered. Xi Ji Li comes in and he realizes that there are these two market forces he can bring together. The Mexican cartels that have all these dollars they want to turn into pesos, and the Chinese elite. China has become a very prosperous country with all these wealthy folks, but who also would like to get their fortunes out of China because there's also, you know, there's vulnerability being in an authoritarian regime. So he realizes that he can bring those two together. And what he does is he tells the Mexican cartels, I can launder your money like in a day for a very little percentage, right? You know, his folks start acquiring from his Mexican cartel contacts, and he knows these contacts because he's sort of grown up around them and worked with them. They acquire the money on the streets of the United States, and his network in Mexico that same day gets a signal from that exchange, and they give the equivalent amount of pesos to the Mexican cartel. So the Mexican cartels are taken care of. They're ecstatic. They've never had such cheap, reliable, fast service where he even guarantees that if a load gets busted, he'll replace it for free. How is he able to do that? Because he is selling that cash to Chinese wealthy, sometimes their kids, sometimes their representatives in the U.S., at a very high commission, because they're able to get dollars now on the streets of the United States, and they've been able to get their money out of China, right? So they're willing to pay him for that. And what he has them do is they pay him by moving that money within Chinese bank accounts in China. So none of this money ever crosses borders. It's all parallel, what are called mirror transactions. So the Chinese elite receive dollars on the streets of the United States from Xi Ji Li and move money from their accounts in China to accounts he controls in China, where he takes that money, now it's Chinese currency now, and he sells it again and makes even more money off of it to companies in Latin American companies, mainly in China, that need Chinese money to acquire goods, to do import-export, right? So it's complicated, but as you said, when you see the graphics, it's actually not that complicated. It's less complicated than it sounds. He's basically making all this money off this cash. And what the Chinese elite are doing in the United States is using it to buy real estate, to pay tuition for their kids, whatever they're able to, you know, they're able to launder it that way. So he's got this system that makes these both sides happy. But again, that can only happen. All that movement I'm talking to you about is something that all the DEA investigators who worked on this case are like, there's no way the Chinese authorities are not seeing this remarkable movement of money, because you've got, you know, hundreds of folks doing this, moving millions of dollars, and there are many others like him that they're not seeing that. So that is a very dramatic development in the drug underworld that really gives great power to the Mexican cartels, because it solves this huge problem they had with getting their money laundered, and it empowers them. It becomes much more difficult for law enforcement, because as law enforcement all over the West will tell you, the Chinese law enforcement doesn't cooperate. So there's all this stuff happening behind this wall of secrecy in China, and everyone's benefiting in the underworld.
Wow. And did he get busted?
He did. He very sharp young DEA agent started working this case, tracking actually cocaine shipments from Memphis, Tennessee, of all places, back to people around Xi Ji Li, including his girlfriend, who was a Chinese Mexican, whose nickname was China Loa, which combines the words China and Sinaloa, which, as you know, is the headquarters of a lot of the cartel. So she really, her name really fused the concept of this alliance, right? So the DEA Special Operations Division starts tracking all these phones in Mexico, and realizing that they're communicating with this network of couriers all over the United States working for Xi Ji Li, and both intercepting loads and then going back and realizing how many of these money handoffs that were happening all over the country between Mexican traffickers and Chinese organized crime, which was something they hadn't seen before, and they're seeing this whole shift. So they track it, and through communications, they're able to start picking off people in the network and get the Mexicans to arrest Xi Ji Li. So they're actually able to arrest him. But by the time he's caught, around 2019, I believe it is, he's a pioneer, but he's not the only one. He represents this wave of folks who have taken over in the United States, in Mexico, Central America, in Canada, which is another huge hub of this, because there's a lot of organized crime in Canada, Chinese organized crime, and they really have incredible capacity to launder through casinos and through other things. The Canadian law enforcement is really behind the times on this. And in my work in Europe, where I spend a lot of time, Chinese organized crime is doing the same thing with drug trafficking there. Not only laundering money, but doing what's called underground banking. So if the Italian mafia in Calabria, the 'Ndrangheta, wants to buy $1 million worth of cocaine in Colombia, they don't send the money. They deal with a Chinese broker in Italy who has a confederate in Colombia, and the money gets moved and the process gets made through that underground banking system without it ever having to cross borders. So Chinese organized crime has really become fundamental all over the world to the laundering and the underground banking business of criminality.
Fascinating, complicated, and made for Hollywood. Right. Do you have time for more stories? I'm going to butcher this name, Zi Zeng. Is it
Zi Zeng?
Yeah. Zi Zeng. He came to the United States illegally and then died working in an Oklahoma marijuana farm. That's also was an incredible story.
It's a very tragic phenomenon that we really dug into deeply in a series. And it's interesting because it grows out of the money laundering. What we realized was that Chinese organized crime had really, with all this money generated by the laundering, all this cash, one of the things it was doing was reinvesting in the Chinese, in the U.S. marijuana industry. And that Chinese organized crime really has taken over the bulk of the U.S. marijuana underworld. In places like California, but particularly Oklahoma, which passed a very liberal sort of wild west type of legalization law that allowed all these folks, many of them in organized crime, to move to Oklahoma where land is cheap, buy farms, and just and grow huge amounts of marijuana that is then sold on the black market, generally in on the East Coast. So what's happened? The folks doing that work at these Chinese-owned marijuana farms, which are often like these grim places with guns and dogs and, you know, and guards, are themselves Chinese immigrant workers, particularly in the past 5 years. As you know, there was a huge increase during the Biden administration of illegal immigration, including folks from China. And more of these folks were coming to these, were being brought by smugglers, sometimes with the express purpose the smugglers were bringing them to work at marijuana farms, and some other times they were making their way there from places like New York or Los Angeles. But there was all this work to be done at these marijuana farms, and that also was a result of the pandemic, where a lot of folks who were working in sweatshops or restaurants or factories, you know, during COVID, they were losing those jobs, but they were finding them out in places like Oklahoma, Colorado, California. So Mr. Zeng is representative of that. Hardworking guy from Fujian, which is the province where a lot of immigrants come from the United States, whether they're at the high level gangsters or the low level, the exploited workers. But he comes by way, you know, his family, he has a family that's well established, very nice folks in New York, who paid $60,000 to smugglers so he could come to the United States, because also he was Christian. So he was, he was having trouble there in China with the authorities. And
he came over where I am with the San Diego border, right?
That's right. But in order to do that, the $60,000 helps pay a bribe to Chinese authorities to let him leave. He makes his way to Bolivia, where the smugglers, he had smugglers who are pretty sophisticated, because many Chinese immigrants fly to a place like Ecuador, and then they make their way by land, by bus, and even by foot through the Darien jungle of between Panama and Colombia, and make their way to Central America and Mexico. He paid enough money that his smuggler was sophisticated, and he flew directly from Bolivia to Mexico, made his way, yes, to Tijuana, and came in like so many Chinese immigrants did during the Biden administration, in particular across the border in San Diego. Basically, when he gets caught, he applies for asylum, he's released, he goes to New York, and he hears he's got a relative working in Oklahoma at the marijuana farm. So he goes to work at a marijuana farm, and right away, and this is a healthy man in his 50s,
and he must have money too. Like, he's $65,000 or $60,000 is not a little. He had money to come,
but that wasn't his money though. That was his family. His family is well established. They've been in the U.S. for a while. They have businesses, but he was basically a farmer. He's not somebody who had money. He's a very hardworking guy. he goes to do this work in Oklahoma, where he's basically working in greenhouses on these farms. But what happens to him has happened to many Chinese workers. The conditions on these farms are atrocious. They're run by criminals. They're mainly Fujianese exploiting their own folks, gangsters exploiting recent arrivals. They rip them off. They don't pay them. They make them work around banned pesticides. They make them work in intense heat. He started complaining to his family that he was being working up to 14 hours a day in these greenhouses where the heat has been documented. It goes up well over 100 degrees, right? I mean, in some of these places. And they're just, it's akin to modern day slavery. And so he's talking to his family. He's getting sick. His family is talking to the bosses of the farm, saying you got to do something. But they take him to a doctor who says he has a urinary tract infection, but basically gives him some medicine. They persuade the bosses to pay for a ticket for him to fly back to New York, because clearly his doctor hadn't done anything. But he passes away there on the farm. And I think and the investigators think that if he hadn't had this family that was concerned about him, we may never have heard about him again. Because what do? They take him dead or dying to a hospital and basically try to dump him at the hospital and leave, right? The doctors and the nurses are working, trying to revive him, and they're trying to get, who are you? What happened? They basically barely give their names. Don't want to give any information. And as the doctors are trying to revive him, the people who are running the farm leave, and he passes away. So this becomes the object of an investigation. We looked into it. We saw that the farm has connections to a series of criminal activities. But sadly, it is emblematic of this, of what is ongoing throughout the United States at marijuana farms, that you have these immigrants working in grim conditions, sometimes being abused, beaten, shot, sometimes being held against their will. We did stories about immigrants, fleeing from farms and running to the neighbors and being chased down by the bosses at these farms. So there's this whole underworld that people should think about, when they're dealing with marijuana, of where this marijuana is coming from. It's coming from slave labor and organized crime. And Mr. Zeng's death is sort of emblematic of that.
So what was his motivation to come to America? Was it for a better life, for an income?
It was, that province is particularly poor, and it has a tradition of migration. And he was he had family, including family that were ill, a child and a parent. So he needed money. And he also had the added issue of being Christian. His family here is Christian, and he was also a convert to Christianity. And it's particularly difficult if you're Christian or some other religion in China, just with the authority. So it was a mix of both the economic and the
and religious freedom. And then what was he paid a day? Like, was this good money for him?
I mean, I think it was decent money, because also, he's living on the farm. So whatever he gets, the wages aren't bad. But the other problem is,
are they paid minimum wage, or they don't follow American law and get?
I mean, it depends. Sometimes the wages are minimum wage or more, and they can be making pretty good money. But the other problem is that often they get paid the first month, and then they stop paying them. Right. I mean, what has happened more and more is that it's a bait and switch. So he was only there for a month, so it's hard to say what would have happened. But in many of the cases we looked at in California and Oklahoma, people will come with a pretty decent, offer of money. And then after the first couple of months, we'll be told, oh, we can't pay you anymore because the harvest wasn't good enough. But when the harvest is better, we'll pay you. Or they're offered, we can't pay you, but if you invest in, a greenhouse, then you can keep the profits, right? Which ends up not happening. So there's a lot of, and a lot of these people do not go to the authorities, right? I mean,
they're illegally.
They're illegal in the country. They often have debts to smugglers. They often know that the organized crime folks know their family back home, because again, even though it seems like a huge distance, they're all from the same province, right? From Fujian. So the people they're working with may well know, be able to threaten their family back home. And it's just very hard to track these people, the culprits down.
Did you see his autopsy report? Like, what did he die of? Was it toxins or dehydration?
Dehydration was definitely part of it. He had an infection that basically, wasn't properly cured and just sort of shut down his system. I believe it's sepsis. Sepsis. Okay. Sepsis and pneumonia.
Oh, pneumonia. Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, the thinking is that he
died of a preventable disease.
Incredibly preventable. And again, we saw his medical records. He'd had a checkup when he'd come to the U.S. at some point in New York, and the guy was in good, you know, he was basically a healthy man in his 50s, right? So, I mean, and you know, it seems clear that he got an infection that wasn't properly treated, and then it became too late, you know.
So what, I don't know if you know this, but what percent of the marijuana grows in America are Chinese mafia?
I would say that a majority of the important ones are, right? In other words, there's a lot of grows of different dimensions, but what we saw in the Pacific Northwest, in the hotbeds, California, Pacific Northwest, Colorado, Oklahoma, the big farms, the big money is Chinese dominated without question, you know? So, I mean, I don't know if the percent would be 75, because it depends if you're talking about a couple of, you know, grows in a house, but the big money is Chinese organized crime. And the DEA and other law enforcement have tried hard to quantify this, and they will admit to you that it's difficult. But what they see is that at the highest levels, it is run by the Chinese organized crime, including the triads like the 14K, the same one that Xi Jinping was connected to. And that a lot of the orders come from New York. In other words, they have detected, because what's remarkable about this, you have all this money and all these criminals, and that they're not, there isn't more violence. We wrote about some cases, there was a quadruple murder in Oklahoma, there is some violence, but usually in other underworld cultures, when you have that much money and that many criminals, they have turf wars and things like that. What the DEA and others have been able to determine is that there's kind of a command structure in New York that dictates turf and money and whatnot, and it keeps the peace. And the DEA even detected senior figures in organized crime flying into New York to sit down with the bosses here to sort of keep all this organized and keep it peaceful. And you have a lot of things that connect back to China, including money coming directly from China to purchase these farms. You know, a lot of the money comes in and then it goes back to China. And you have things like folks who are clearly, you know, working or lower middle class from China being brought in just long enough to make a purchase of homes, like ghost buyers, right? Just to set up marijuana grows and then going back. So then when the place gets busted, you know, the owner isn't around, right? So it's very sophisticated and it's international in scope. What is striking is that the same thing is going on in Spain, which is kind of the center of marijuana production and distribution in Europe. And there also Chinese organized crime is very, very involved in. And in Chile, in South America, you also have the same thing. So there's this worldwide network and this worldwide movement of workers to supply the low level work for these farms.
Is the Chinese marijuana grows, is that in order to make a profit over the marijuana users in America, or is it a way to launder money, or both?
I think it's both. It's both. In other words, you have to think about, I think the people who know more about this than me and law enforcement have said, think about Chinese organized crime being involved in multiple activities, right? The extortion, obviously, it's always been within the diaspora community, contraband, money laundering, movement of smuggling of migrants and of things, right? But at the heart of it is this question of the money they're making and their control of cash and their ability to launder money. So what happens with the marijuana is, as the DEA is looking at their growth into the laundering of cash for the Mexican cartels and all this cash they're generating on the streets of the United States, part of that cash is going to the Chinese elite, but part of it is being reinvested into this new opportunity in marijuana. Because there's all this legalization going on, the thinking is and the penalties are softer. They're moving into these places with the fig leaf of the facade of legality, but of course they're breaking all these laws immediately. You know, it's legal to grow marijuana in Oklahoma, but you're only supposed to grow it for medicinal purposes and sell it within Oklahoma. They're making enough marijuana for the entire population of Brazil to smoke, get high every day, right? I mean, what they're doing is growing that marijuana and moving it and selling it on the black market. So it's both a way to launder, but it's also a way to make even more profits and generate even more cash. And the numbers are just, when I first saw the numbers, I thought they were mistakes, because the numbers, they're making billions and billions of dollars just in Oklahoma. I mean, it's really a remarkably lucrative underworld that sadly has kind of subverted, you know, I've covered drug trafficking and I've, you know, as you have followed it all, you know, for a long time. And the argument with legalization is always, well, you know, it's going to bring it all out into the open. It's going to make money for the government. It's going to eliminate organized crime. What's happened, at least in what I've seen in the marijuana industry in the United States, is that it has systematically created an opportunity where organized crime has rushed in.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The opposite.
And it's amazing that government doesn't see that. Like, you know, in California, our state has refused to put any real protections, public health protections of marijuana, because they see the big green dollar of the profits of what they think is legal industry, and yet the illegal industry has grown. I'm wondering, what is the connection? So a lot of the, you know, if you go to a dispensaries, some of them look like an Apple shop, and it's beautiful, gorgeous, American businessmen's executives are running these things. But I'm kind of thinking, when I look at the product, is what part of the product here came from these illegal grows? And did they get that marijuana legally to sell, or is there a connection again now with these Chinese mafia grows?
And this is not a part that we looked at as intensely as some of the other stuff, because we were very focused on what was happening in these states in terms of the rise of crime and the different kinds of crime it causes, like environmental damage, forcing women into prostitution to service the owners of the and the managers of these farms. But on that aspect, the question you asked, certainly there's a lot of marijuana just being sold on the black market on the streets. So because in Oklahoma, you take the, or California, the dope is going to New York, Philadelphia, Florida, et cetera, and you can make a lot more money. But there were, I have been told by DEA agents about cases where they found that this black market marijuana was making its way into theoretically officially sanctioned, you know, brick and mortar shops and places that were supposed to be part of the legitimate marijuana.
Right?
Business.
How could it not? It's obviously probably so much cheaper.
There's a temptation there, right? Because you just, you know, the profit margins have suddenly, you know, changed. So there is some of that going on, yes, as far as I can tell.
So somebody is, you know, lighting up a joint. You know, when we buy things in the store, it's always like vegan free, no animal cruelty went into this makeup or whatever that you're buying. And yet if you light up a joint, chances are you're assisting Chinese laundering, prostitution, all those things that are connected with mafia type crime.
I think so. And I think it's like, you know, there's a lot of, as you say, that's very true what you just said. There's a lot of concern that we're not acquiring products that are used, you know, made through slave labor, exploitation of people. I mean, this workforce is one of the most exploited and abused workforces I've ever seen. And again, they themselves are Chinese, right? I mean, they're immigrants in this country. And, you know, the conditions they're in, the lack of hygiene, the lack of food, the sleeping, you know, on the floor, again, pesticides, fire hazards, every and any kind of, you know, workplace danger you can imagine, not to mention extortion, abuse, rape, shooting, beating, you know, at being held against their will, you know, slavery type conditions. You know, I've had investigators get emotional talking to me about going into these places and seeing what is clearly human trafficking and slavery and not being able to make a case because no one will talk. And we interviewed Mr. Zhang's family. We also interviewed a gentleman named Lin who fled a farm, you know, where he was, you know, there were armed criminal guards, you know, guarding them. And there were some of his fellow workers had been brought across the Mexican border and sold to the owners of the farm and told, okay, now you work at this farm and you're going to work here for the next 2 years. Whether you like it or not, to work off your debt. And they were held physically in that farm. He actually ended up escaping from that farm after the boss of the farm, when he went to demand his wages, which he hadn't got, put an AK-47 to his head, you know, and told him to go away. So, you know, when people who are thinking about where their marijuana comes from should think about that, what, you know, the human cost of these workers on these farms.
And where is OSHA and law enforcement and, you know, in regulating and or closing these places? Are there just too many that we don't find them? I mean, it's unbelievable to know that we have third world conditions here under our nose in the United States.
there's more and more effort being made, but, you know, there's a lot of these farms, and it depends. In California, for example, where there's the state OSHA is more robust, there's more regulation. In Oklahoma, where
But in California, it's all in the, you know, we have huge forests, and most of these illegal grows are in public lands in deep forests, where it's hard to find.
Right, exactly. So you have theoretically a bureaucracy that is more muscular and could do more about it, and there are more rules and laws, but they're just hard to enforce because of that clandestine aspect. In Oklahoma, you have all these huge farms all over the place, but you have a very weak system where marijuana is kind of in this loophole that work where it isn't. It's theoretically that the federal government is supposed to do it, but the state is supposed to do it, and nobody ends up doing it, and it kind of fell between the cracks. So that's a huge problem, too. Every once in a while, like, for example, and we wrote about a quadruple murder fight among Chinese gangsters in Oklahoma that brought all this attention to it, so the government started to crack down. But it's very hard to do, also because the federal government was really enforcing the marijuana stuff, only doing big cases, only doing cases that they connected to organized crime. So you really need the federal law enforcement to get involved in this, because what we found is how incredibly mobile and connected these groups are. So if you have a group in Oklahoma, they probably have farms in California, in Colorado, New Mexico. They're bouncing around the country. Many of them are really folks from organized crime groups in New York or Los Angeles. So the only way to go after them is at a federal level. There were cases when Oklahoma became a boom territory in 2018, 2019, 2020. California had been the place where a lot of the Chinese criminal groups were. The federal authorities, to the extent they were getting involved in it, were seeing that these Chinese mafia groups were flying by private plane, flying from California to Oklahoma, landing often at, you know, semi-clandestine strips, you know, with suitcases of money to go out and buy these farms to set up business. So they're really organized, right? And really mobile.
Amazing. I think that's a story I was going to have you tell about the Chen brothers, which it was another made-for-Hollywood story where instead of, you know, the Godfather, where, you know, the mafia's meeting at an Italian restaurant and, you know, eating, you know, spaghetti and meatballs, they're in a Chinese restaurant, and that all, you know, happens there.
Yeah, I mean, that was the quadruple murder I mentioned, where we originally traced the victims and the killer in this case and showed the rise of Chinese organized crime and marijuana. You had these brothers named Chen who come, from Fujian province. Typical arrival in New York, where almost everyone arrives first, usually in Flushing or in the traditional Chinatown of Manhattan. They go to North Carolina for a while, where they have restaurants, but then they show up. They hadn't really gotten in trouble with the law, but it was pretty clear they were involved in organized crime, because they show up with a group of folks when everyone's going out to California early in the past decade and start buying these big, both whether houses in the city or houses, semi-rural houses, and setting up groves. They get busted, but nothing really happens to them. You know, the first offense, slap on the wrist, and they move immediately to Oklahoma, buy a huge farm. You know, I mean, money seems to be no object. Bring out, you know, a couple dozen workers and get to work generating all this money. They are particularly violent, and they're connected to, and this is where we found the connection to the Chinese state. This huge Chinese population kind of superimposes itself in Oklahoma, which kind of freaks out the existing Chinese population, which is very law-abiding and peaceful. But you have all these sort of swaggering gangsters showing up in Oklahoma, and they create this, the Fujianese Association in Oklahoma City, which is a place which is immediately becomes a target of police investigations for gambling and human trafficking and other things. And the Chen brothers are involved in a dispute where they go to this association and they end up getting in a fight and shooting a guy and wounding him. They get arrested. They get, of course, released on bail. They go back to this big farm where they're working. But then they have a conflict with one of their partners, who's a very mysterious character who had come, and I think we had an exclusive on this, he had come by way of Spain, Cuba, Minnesota, and made his way to this farm and was their partner.
Is that Tao Liu? Is that the guy?
No, his name was also Chen, so it gets confusing. But basically, they have a dispute. He leaves. He comes back to the farm one day and starts shooting and kills both the Chen brothers, and he kills four people and wounds another. He flees to Florida, where he's in touch with a Chinese human trafficker, where his plan is to get exfiltrated from Florida, probably back to Cuba, but the police are able to track him down. In his hearing to be extradited back to Oklahoma, He tells the judge in open court, this is a guy who's committed four murders, by the way. He says, don't send me back to Oklahoma because they're all gangsters there and they're going to kill me. I mean, there's clearly all this incredible organized crime stuff going on there. In fact, the cops who bring him back say they are followed by mysterious vehicles and, you know, have to elude them as they're trying to drive him back. One of the things that's striking, there's a couple of things that's striking. One, just in terms of the squalor they discover at this farm where the cops, when they're looking for these folks, when they go in, you know, to the scene of the shooting is incredible. At night, they're going through what they think is mud. And then the day they realize it's human excrement, that like these people are living in these incredible abhorrent conditions. But what is also interesting is the aftermath, which is that the Chinese consul general rushes from Washington to Oklahoma to meet with the leaders of the community about this quadruple murder. And he meets with them at the Fujianese Association, where that shooting had happened and where all these folks were connected to different kinds of criminality that had been investigated by state and federal law enforcement. And we got the pictures and identified the people that the consul met with at this meeting and a subsequent meeting 6 months later at that same place. And we identified half a dozen convicted or accused criminals who are leaders of the community who are meeting with the consul general. It's kind of hard to imagine that the consul general doesn't know who he's meeting with and who is representing the Chinese community. These people, in addition to being involved in crimes, are connected to diaspora associations in New York that are very connected both with US and Chinese politicians. And several of them are connected to a Fujianese association in New York that was investigated and two people were charged, one convicted by the federal government for running a secret Chinese police station in Manhattan, which Chinese police used to harass and stalk dissidents and folks in China. So you have all these convergences of crime and state happening in the middle of, you know, Oklahoma City, which is very, you know, that are very strange. You have a lot of people who are prominent in the Chinese marijuana underworld who are also prominent leaders of the diaspora community and have connections to the Chinese Communist Party, the Chinese diplomats, and also are involved in American politics and giving donations and showing up.
Yeah.
So you really have to wonder what's going on in this underworld.
It's fascinating. Sebastian, your reporting is amazing. the stories. This is the last kind of article that you wrote. What else are you working on?
Well, I mean, there's more to do on some of these issues, I think, on some of the activity in Mexico that allows this and maybe some of the connections between the Chinese and Mexican forces. But, you know, I'm doing, as always, sort of issues related to Latin America, international organized crime, and things like that.
Yeah. Movies, TV series. I mean, I just think this is made for Hollywood. Type.
There's some interest in the, there has been interest in a couple of the stories. And I also have a border related thing I'm working on, a potential TV project. So there's always something going on.
That's amazing. Sebastian Rotella, thank you so much for joining us. And for our listeners, you should check out his publication and also his novels. They'll be in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.